generally speaking, people who don't have much knowledge of the system probably aren't going to be organized enough to get things. It's just unfortunate, but it's just the reality of our society, I think.
Learning the art of lobbying the legislature. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, January 11th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, there's no end in sight for the snowplow crews in Anchorage.
There's just so much snow out here right now, so things could get real interesting here in the next day or two.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD. Also, paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Tomorrow, two Alaska journalists will finish a month-long embedding experience with the Fort Wainwright Stryker Brigade in their combat deployment in Afghanistan. The brigade has sustained heavy casualties, 21 dead at last count, and many more than that wounded. The two reporters spoke with APRN's Steve Heimel today about what they had seen.
Both journalists paid their own expenses for this assignment, and their work is appearing on the Internet and in the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. Cheryl Hatch developed a relationship with the 1st Battalion, 5th Infantry Regiment when she taught at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Photojournalist J.R.N. Chetta of Sitka was one of her students and is now in his sophomore year at UAF. He was part of a group that went to watch the soldiers train last February at Fort Irwin NTC Training Center in California. In mid-December, J.R.R. Chetta found himself landing in Kandahar, Afghanistan. It was huge, he said, like a city.
At the dining facility, DFAC, we had a rocket attack, and, you know, we were washing our hands, and we heard this British accent woman going, rocket attack, rocket attack. And then people fell under their, you know, people around us fell on the floor, flat off the floor, and we were just looking at each other, and like, what the hell is going on? So that was surprising, and you know, the person who gave us a place was like, okay, you're fine, don't worry about it, just go inside.
For this embedding, the two were acting as a team, with Archetta doing the photos and Hatch doing the writing. Commanding Officer Lieutenant Colonel Brian Payne told them right away that while he would do his best to keep them out of harm's way, he also wanted to give them plenty of access. Hatch says it could easily have been a routine, feel-good, morale-boosting holiday story, but it turned out to be a lot more than that.
We were allowed to go out on an air assault mission with Charlie Company. So I think we've been, well, in many ways extraordinarily lucky. One, to go out and to walk with these soldiers, and you know, we had 40 pounds of body armor and probably a 35-pound rucksack, and we walked in, plus gear, GR ads, we walked in the line with them behind the Valen, you know, metal detector, and we spent the night out in the open with them, and it gave us a chance to really be, as I said, as close to them and their experience as possible.
It has been such an eventful experience that both journalists say they still have a lot more stories to file that they haven't yet had time to do. And the soldiers? They're having to grow up fast. The two have known some of them for a year now, and the pictures show what constant threat, uncertainty, responsibility, duty, and heavy casualties can do.
JR compared photos that he had taken at the NTC with a lot of these soldiers we've seen again here, and comparing the photos from NTC with what they look like now, and you can see that they've aged, and in their eyes, you can see their eyes are altered. You can definitely see the wear and tear on their bodies and their souls, I would say.
She says that being closer in age to the soldiers and being a man, photojournalist J.R. Archetta could go places where she could not and be more deeply embedded with the soldiers as they face the challenges of their deployment. Here is a story that they have not filed yet because it just happened. They went to an Army medical center. J.R. says he almost didn't go. He was thinking about getting pictures of that boardwalk at the base's airstrip with all the fast food restaurants, a taste of home at the base, inside the wire, as they call it. But instead, he decided to go in.
And took a deep breath before I entered the curtain and went toward Cheryl and introduced myself to the soldier. And his name is PFC Rex Tharp. And we introduced, you know, I introduced myself to him. Cheryl introduced, made a good connection. And I, you know, told him where I was from. And I said I was from Sitka, Alaska. And he was like, oh, well, Mel here next to me is from Alaska. And so I turned my head and was like, whoa, I know this guy. And he, you know, said, J.R. and Cheddar, what the hell are you doing here? So, you know, I went, rushed next to him and started, you know, talking to him. And so that's what happened today.
That soldier was Specialist Joe Mill of Sitka. He was a freshman at Sitka High, while Archetta was a senior. His injury came from an improvised explosive device while on patrol. He's missing the lower part of his leg. Along with their pieces in the news, Minor G.R. Archetta's photographs are published at the Zuma Press website, and Cheryl Hatch is blogging and including G.R.'s photos at north2tothefuture.wordpress.com. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Missile defense will have a long presence in Alaska. That was the message of Missile Defense Agency Director Lieutenant General Pat O'Reilly to the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce in an address yesterday. The Fort Greely Missile Base with 26 interceptors is the centerpiece of the nation's ground-based mid-course missile defense system. The $18 billion Fort Greely facility is nearing completion, and O'Reilly said his agency is committed to operate and maintain it for the long term.
We do see the life of this system going to 2030 to make a decision about how much longer. Typically, decisions made at that time for a system like this, they usually add at least 10 to 20 more years to it. So what we tell our workforce there at Fort Greely is what they're doing is to protect not only their children, but their children's children. And we have a very long commitment beyond halfway through this next century.
General O'Reilly said a dangerous political climate in the world is driving the long-term commitment. O'Reilly cited smaller nations like North Korea and Iran, which possess thousands of missiles that Alaska is in a key place to intercept.
From North Korea's launch sites to us is about 6,000 kilometers. From Iran, it's about 8,000 kilometers. But what most people don't notice if they look at a flat map of the planet Earth is because we're right here up at Fort Greely, any missile coming out of Iran heading to the east coast of the United States, it's providing a perfect shot opportunity for us.
O'Reilly said the ideal location of Fort Greely means continued commitment to maintain the site as part of the multi-element missile defense system. That includes another missile launch site in California. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, hardy Yukon swans that refuse to migrate.
We've seen them over our place, which is at least 10 miles from the open water, and they fly right over the house.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
The start of the legislative session in Juneau means more than lawmakers returning to the Capitol. Lobbyists will be returning as well. The picture of a cigar-chomping, glad-handing lobbyist is no longer an accurate one, according to consultant Clive Thomas. Thomas has made a career out of studying political advocacy. A self-styled political junkie, Thomas has spent about three decades researching and writing about interest groups. He also teaches the basics of lobbying in workshops like the one he just completed in Anchorage. With this year's state legislature about about to convene, a good many municipal advocates and community service nonprofits are thinking about how to convince lawmakers to support their projects. But success on that score could be like gazing into a crystal ball, Thomas says.
When you operate in politics, you operate with very minimal information, and you're always operating about something that's going to happen in the future that you can't predict. And so the only way that you can survive is by dealing with people that you can trust, or that you can trust their information.
He says, contrary to popular perception, the most important tool in a lobbyist's arsenal is trust. Thomas says that lobbying is the art of getting what you want, and that takes tremendous know-how and lots of people skills.
Really, you've got to understand about human beings and how to deal with them in this political situation. And there are personalities.
Thomas's workshop was attended almost exclusively by those representing city administrations and small organizations. Attendee Steve Hicks said federal funding sources are drying up. Hicks heads the nonprofit Alaska Association of Conservation Districts. AACD works with the state on natural resource and agricultural issues, but is not a state-funded agency. Hicks says he's seeing lobbyists now in a new light.
They're actually more of an educator. They help the legislators determine what are good projects and not, because they can be succinct. And they also not only just point out the good things, they can also point out the bad, because one of the things when they develop their trust with the legislator, they have to know what might come up and hit them from behind and be prepared for all things. So I think it was a real good eye-opener for a lot of us.
With weighty issues like the coastal management plan and oil tax legislation bound to be on the front burner this legislative session, smaller concerns will have to speak up to be heard. Thomas says lobbying is part of the political process.
Basically, it's about being an effective citizen and how to sort of organize yourself for what we might call lobbying, which is kind of a dirty word, but it's an important word in our society, protected by the First Amendment of the Constitution. So what I'm trying to do is help people to understand the way that the process works in Juneau, and then organize to get their point over.
Thomas says his workshops help people form a plan, and that is essential. The key, he says, is making lawmakers want to help you. Although the political atmosphere can be intimidating, Thomas stresses that lawmakers are very busy people who don't get paid very well. His advice: learn how to communicate your message briefly. Today has been a day of logistics for the Healy and the Renda. The ships have not moved toward Nome since yesterday. The Healy had to get into position to launch its helicopter this morning. Vitus Marine hired their own ice expert, who flew out to the vessels this afternoon to help with the remainder of the delivery. Officials are hopeful the vessels will reunite this evening and continue their voyage to Nome. The ultimate price to consumers of the fuel aboard the Renda is still unknown. The tanker's long journey across the Pacific and the slow progress through the ice, however, should not have a dramatic effect on the final price. KNOM's Ben Matheson has the story.
Gas and diesel are running low in Nome. Bonanza Fuel ran out of diesel around Christmas and has been purchasing fuel from Crowley's inventory since then. Gasoline is running extremely low, according to Sitnasauk. The Renda's payload of 1.3 million gallons should bring the supplies necessary to make the summer barge season. The price of that fuel to consumers in Nome, however, is still an open question. The cost of chartering the Russian tanker through Vitus Marine is not fully known, according to Sitnasauk board chair Jason Evans.
Some of those costs are variable based on the ultimate return of the ship to its home port. So, you know, we won't know our final cost for the next couple of weeks or so.
The fuel bound for Nome aboard the Renda has been slogging through the ice for nearly a week. The Renda and Healy have far overrun the earlier projections, calling for a 4 or 5 day trip from Dutch Harbor to Nome. The latest delays are in addition to complications in attempting to load gasoline in Japan and ultimately filling up with less gas in Dutch Harbor. But Evans says the delays and complications in the journey should not have a big impact for the consumer in Nome.
There was a small increase if the delivery took longer, and right now we're operating within the time frame that we thought the delivery would arrive, and you know, factored in some extra time to deliver the fuel. So I think we're well within that at this point in time. Should that small increase trigger fairly minor in comparison to just a normal delivery of fuel.
Another factor in the final price is the role of Delta Western, the company that was originally scheduled to deliver the fuel this fall. When Sitnisok was exploring options to fly in fuel, they were calling on Delta to, quote, pay a fair share to protect consumers. Evans says conversations are ongoing between the two companies, and Delta Western did sell Bonanza the 300,000 gallons of gasoline in Dutch Harbor. Evans says the conclusions to what went wrong in September and October and who ultimately pays will not be resolved now.
Most of our time and energy is focused on getting the Renda safely arrived and known, and also preparing for all things that we need to do to offload the fuel.
Another variable in the supply and demand equation is that Nome has experienced a cold snap in recent weeks. The last time Nome was above zero was Christmas Eve. Evan says Bonanza has been selling more heating fuel than normal, although the heating fuel supplies should be adequate. The diesel aboard the Renda can be used for heating if necessary after being blended with heating fuel. Evan says that if the tanker were unable to make it into Nome, the option remains to fly in fuel on hundreds of flights of tanker aircraft. This could add $3 to $4 per gallon to delivery costs. Evan says he's confident in the Renda and Healy's ability to make it in. Reporting in Nome, I'm Ben Matheson.
And while the price of fuel will most likely not reach $9 a gallon in Nome this winter, some residents in the coldest parts of the state pay the highest prices. KNOM's Lorelei Kanin has more.
With a long list of agencies working toward the safe delivery of the fuel to Nome to keep costs low for residents, a number of communities throughout rural Alaska already pay a price that would make Nome residents shudder. In Kobuk, a community of about 150 people in the interior northwest region of Alaska, residents pay $9.50 for a gallon of gasoline and $9.30 for heating fuel. The city orders a plane load of fuel just about every month in the winter from Fairbanks. Barging fuel is not an option. The community faced a fuel shortage this week, but a delivery was made just this afternoon. And in Noatak, a community of just more than 500 people north of Kotzebue, residents pay $8.99 for both gasoline and heating fuel. With the high cost of energy, Noatak resident Carl Wilson says people in Noatak make tough decisions between food and fuel every day.
What can you do? You know, so cold, you know, you have to pay for whatever they ask you.
Noatak, like Kobuk, has no choice but to fly the fuel in. Wilson says the fuel pumps at the Noatak Native store froze due to the weeks of 35 to 45 below temperatures, and employees today were manually pumping heating fuel to customers. Meanwhile, 223 miles to the south, the Coast Guard, State of Alaska, City of Nome, Sitnisok, Vitus Marine, and other agencies are and have been working together to get the historic fuel shipment to Nome. Carl Wilson says folks in Noatak are and have always done the same.
We're real cold right now, and helping each other out is probably one of the greatest resources out there in this situation.
Reporting in Nome, I'm Lorelei Kinneen.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
It may be hard for residents of South Central Alaska to believe, but there is more snow in the forecast, a lot more snow. The National Weather Service expects the storm to start late tonight in the Anchorage area. By the time it's all over, 24 hours later, 8 to 16 inches of new snow could be on the ground. For the Matsu Valley, the predicted snow totals are a bit tamer, only 5 to 11 inches. And in case Valdez and Cordova were concerned about missing out on this latest round, National Weather Service meteorologist Dave Snyder says not to worry.
Valdez and Cordova are once again set up for a pretty respectable snow totals. Valdez is going to probably be the big winner this time, anywhere from about 1 to 2 feet of snow. The forecasters have 11 to 22 inches defined in the forecast there through Thursday, but it still looks like it may snow into Thursday night, and in some cases maybe Friday around Prince William Sound before it shuts down.
In Cordova, forecasters are expecting 5 to 11 inches of snow by Thursday evening. Snyder says the constant storms have been impressive, especially for a newcomer to the state.
This is my first winter in Anchorage, and the running joke seems to be if I can make it through this winter, I'll be just fine up here. There's kind of a nervous laughter around the office from time to time when we see another storm moving through. This is what meteorologists live for. We enjoy the usual and normal weather, and we enjoy the unusual weather even just a little bit more.
And after this coming storm, will we dry out for a while? Possibly. In Anchorage, at least, the forecast calls for clear skies and cold temperatures this weekend through at least early next week. Anchorage is on pace to break the city's snowfall record this winter. The 80 or so inches that has fallen so far is about double the average, and the city is now bracing for another gigantic wallop of the white stuff. APRN's Annie Feit got a tour of the city's snowplow operations as crews were finishing clearing the streets after the last snow and preparing for the next storm.
Paul Van Landingham has spent 15 years working in the city's street maintenance division, and it's not as if he's never seen a winter as snowy as this one, but he says it has been a while.
It is Alaska, we have to do our best, but, if we could just get a break of more than 3 or 4 days without a snowstorm, we could really do some good.
Van Landingham mentions this idea of getting a break several times throughout the tour. It's as if he hopes repeating it enough times may somehow make it come true. But he's realistic, too, and knows it doesn't look like a break is coming anytime soon.
There's just so much snow out here right now, and then calling for another 10 to 18 inches here in the next 2 days. So things could get real interesting here in the next day or two.
When you saw that forecast, what did you think?
That's not what I wanted to see this morning.
It takes the crew about 3 days to plow the snow from the city's streets. Then they shift into snow removal mode, scooping or blowing the snow into huge dump trucks. With another storm on the way, crews are trying to accomplish both tasks. But Van Landingham takes me to a neighborhood in South Anchorage where the traditional plows are operating, scraping the snow off the road and pressing it into the already substantial snowbanks. The city plows 1,400 miles of road, and given the snowfall this winter, Van Landingham says it's been hard to keep up. That means the crews aren't moving as fast as many Anchorage residents would like to see.
We're getting a lot of complaints this year, just because of the volume of snow. We're not doing anything different than we've done in the past, other than there's just a lot more snow than we've had in a lot of years, and, it falls overnight, but it doesn't go away overnight.
Van Landingham says a lot of the complaints involve the city's cul-de-sacs. He says there are 1,400 of them to maintain, and many are stuffed full of snow. Snow removal crews are working to open them up, transporting snow to one of the city's snow dump sites. But they are rapidly filling up. Van Landingham is trying to locate two huge bulldozers to rent to level off the dumps.
Street maintenance is Paul. Hey, Griffin, what's up?
At a stop on the tour, he takes a call from a potential supplier, but it's as if he's speaking a foreign language.
That 6R, if I'm going to go that big, I'm going to go with an 8. If you got an 8R available, that's probably the direction I'd go instead of the 6.
Van Landingham says he likes being a manager, dealing with the logistics and schedules and bulldozer rentals. But a little wistfully, he says he does miss being the guy out on the road.
Actually, compared to what I do now, it was very relaxing. When you're in residentials, it's good. I mean, it's fun. It's a fun job. You're in that huge piece of machinery moving snow, and you know, and you work at a decent pace, and you know, you can look back and see a job done.
Getting the job done has meant lots of overtime for the crew this winter, but it's still too early to say what impact that will have on the city's budget. The new fiscal year began January 1st, so if it stops snowing next week, the budget would be in fine shape. But somehow, that doesn't seem likely to happen. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
In the Yukon, an annual harbinger of spring may be turning into a sign of global warming. Yukon's year-round swan population is growing. It started about 5 years ago when a pair of hardy swans refused to fly south for the winter. CBC's Vic Ischenko has the story.
That's the sound of springtime in the Yukon, when thousands of swans congregate in the ice-free headwaters of the Yukon River. It's been months since these magnificent birds left their northern breeding grounds and headed south for warmer climes, except for these hardy hangers-on. These swans have taken up permanent residency around the open waters at Johnson's Crossing, about 100 kilometers east of Whitehorse.
They're really hardy birds, and they'll basically winter as far north as they can.
Bird biologist Jim Hawkins has been monitoring the Johnson's Crossing swans since they first overwintered.
As long as they've got some open water and something to eat, you know, that's the big thing. They've got to have something to eat. We certainly haven't had the cold weather this winter, and unless we do have it, I think they'll probably just sail through the winter.
Jim Clark lives just upriver from the birds on Teslin Lake.
We've seen them over our place, which is at least 10 miles from the open water, and they fly right over the house.
Clark says the Johnson's Crossing flock now numbers 14 swans, including 8 juveniles.
With the increasing number of the juveniles, so their breeding is working out well, and they're overwintering, maybe those young birds just aren't following the migration. And we've got more overwintering, and we're going to have more broods down the road. I don't know.
Birdwatchers say they can only speculate on how many resident swans the area can support. They've survived 40 below temperatures in the past. When it gets cold, the swans just huddle in a group and curl their beaks back into their tail feathers. Vic Ischenko, Johnson's Crossing.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Ross in Fairbanks, Ben Matheson and Lorelei Kanin in Nome, and Vic Ischenko in Canada. APRN's Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer, Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. The statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. Nominations are due by February 14th.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. And it's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. And good things will happen for the causes you care about. This message sponsored by ConocoPhillips Alaska and Mattsu Health Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.